What kind of shift happens in the brain that prepares us for adulthood? How do homework, electronics, and sleep patterns affect the teenage brain? And what are two fundamental processes that drastically change the brain during adolescence? We'll get into all this and more, plus practical applications for integrating brain science into your life and work. Welcome to the Keys to Brain Change with Dr. Daniel Siegel and Dr. Ruth Buzinski.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Dr. Ruth Buzinski, the president of the National Institute for the Clinical Application of Behavioral Medicine, and I'm also a licensed psychologist in the state of Connecticut, and I'm so glad that you're joining us. My guest is not new to many of us. He is Dr. Daniel Siegel. He is a physician, a psychiatrist, and he's clinical professor of psychiatry at UCLA School of Medicine, as well as the co-director of the Mindful Awareness Research Center at UCLA. He's published many, many books. He's authored many books, but he published Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. And we're going to spend our time today focusing on the teenage brain. So welcome, Dan. It's good to see you again.
Thanks, Ruth. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'd like to jump right in. First, I suppose, you know, we should define what we mean by the teenage brain. Just what ages are we looking at here, roughly?
Well, you know, the word teenage usually refers to 13 through 19. In this book, we're talking about the adolescent mind, which is a period adolescence that extends beyond the teenage years. So we're really thinking about the second dozen years of life, 12 to 24. The teenage brain idea is that, in fact, the major changes that begin during the teenage years actually continue into our mid-20s.
Okay. Now, teenagers are notorious, or at least they're perceived to be notorious for high-risk behaviors. Does that have to do with their brains? I'm going to send you an easy question there. Is that related to their brains?
Well, the first thing to start with is, you know, when parents are concerned about teenage risk behaviors, they're actually absolutely correct to be concerned, because the research shows that risky behaviors that lead to accidents and permanent damage to the body, as well as fatalities from suicide and from murder, are actually extremely high, three times more likely during the adolescent period. So while the adolescent period, 12 to 24, is a time when your body is actually the healthiest to fight off disease, it is true that it's the most dangerous. Now, your next part of your question is, you know, is this due to what's going on in the brain? And our understanding now is that the changes that happen in the brain help us understand why risky behaviors, thrill-seeking, pushing boundaries, doing things that are dangerous, are actually prevalent during this period of time. And our new understanding of the brain and how it changes helps illuminate some of the reasons why risk-taking behaviors are there.
Okay, so let's jump in. And are there particular studies, or can you? What do we know about why they're so prone to risky behavior?
Well, the question of why is a great question, and it helps us as parents, it helps us as therapists, it helps us as adolescents to actually approach this period of time to optimize the chance of something positive. So the first way of responding to a why question is to look at the big picture. What's the purpose of adolescence anyway? So whether we know the brain mechanisms, now we know some of them and we'll talk about them, but the why really starts with, why would an adolescent do things a child would not do? Why would an adolescent be doing things that later on in life, when you're 45, you generally don't do? So the big response to why is very important. And for the popular media, what people have said is, well, adolescents are just impulsive because they're out of their minds, they're nuts, some people say, and this period of time is when they're really not able to think correctly because they're immature, and it's just a necessary period of immaturity that you just got to get through. And when I had my two teenagers now move through their teenage years and become in their early 20s, they're still adolescents, but as they move to that period, I look to the literature, both in the popular literature and in the popular media, and I was shocked to find that those sources of knowledge about adolescents and why they do what they do was actually very different from the science. So one of the reasons I wrote the book Brainstorm was to actually clarify for the general public what the science was saying about the adolescent period, including the brain, but then to write a book that was as much for the adolescent to read herself or himself as for parents or professionals. There was no book out there that is for both the adolescent to read and the parent to read that dives deeply into the nature of the brain and actually debunks the myths that are out there. So the first thing to say about why is a simple statement, that adolescence is defined as the period between childhood dependency and adult responsibility. And in the old days, 150 years ago, it used to be about 2 years long, 2 or 3 years. Now it's way past a dozen years. In fact, in some cases, 24 years. And this period between child and adolescence is actually not thought of, from my interpretation of the science, as a period of immaturity, but a necessary period of transformation that requires that the adolescent brain change in such a fashion that you get ready to take risks in order to leave the nest and in order to create a new world. And when you look at this from, let's call it an adaptive point of view, the big question about why, and we'll talk about the mechanisms of how next, but the big question of why is that to leave home, you've got to have some fundamental shift. Think about it this way, Ruth. You wake up in the morning, the sun is rising, someone comes into your bedroom and loves you like crazy and kisses you on the forehead and says, Ruthie, can I make you some breakfast? It's time to get up. And you say, okay, mom, dad. You then get up and your breakfast is made. You get dressed, you put on your shoes, you go to preschool, let's say. You go to elementary school, you play, you learn, you soak in knowledge, you have fun, you come home, maybe you take a nap. Maybe you have a snack, you dance around, you watch a little TV, and then this loving person says to you, Ruthie, would you like to have a little dinner now? It's time for dinner, and then we're going to get ready for bed, and I'll give you a bath, put you in bed, I'll sing you a song, and I'll tell you a story, and you drift off to sleep. Now, who would want to leave that kind of setup? You know, I mean, most of us are trying to get it back, you know, with our spouses. So In this sense, you've got to have some fundamental evolutionarily determined, genetically programmed change in the brain from that childhood way of being cared for by your attachment figure to get ready to leave that situation. And the thing is, the world outside of our familiar home, whether it's great or not so great even, at least it's familiar, the world outside the home is inherently risky. It's uncertain. It's full of potential dangers. And so you've got to have things going on in the brain, we'll talk about next, that shift to tell this individual now moving from childhood to the adolescent transformation period, not immaturity, but necessary transformation. The brain changes in such a fashion to say, risks are not only something I'm willing to take, they're something I'm compelled to take. And that's what's going to allow this individual to do two things. Leave the home, and for our species as a whole, try out new ways of living so as the ever-changing world is emerging, you now can actually have this situation where the adolescent is able to adapt and move out to all corners of the planet. So instead of the adult ways where we become familiar with how to deal with what we've learned to deal with, now the adolescent is in an open state, taking risks, trying out new things, creatively exploring stuff, driven with passion, and goes out to try to populate the world. And therefore, our species supports that. All mammals have adolescence, as far as we can tell. Humanity has taken advantage of this, and adolescents, in many ways, are the most courageous and creative elements of our society, the most creative and courageous individuals in our human family.
You know, I think if you're a school teacher or the guidance counselor at the school or a mom or dad, you would say, yes, but how do I, you know, but my child is, when I talk to my child to prepare him or her for the fact that certain things like driving fast or driving and drinking or driving with other kids is risky. They seem to know all that, and with me, they agree that that's an unwise thing to do, but they do it anyway when they're when they're out with those kids. So what is it, is that just human nature or is something going on there brain-wise?
Well, that's a great way to say it. Well, let's look at the mechanisms first and then look at the pathway to trying to reduce risk. The mechanisms we believe are in place have to do with something I remember with the acronym ESSENCE. And that spells the word essence. So the essence of adolescence is comprised of the following four dimensions. The first is ES, emotional spark. So if you take what we've done, I think, in past courses, Ruth, if you take your hand model of the brain and take your thumb, fold in the middle of your palm, and fold your fingers over the top, this is a pretty useful model of the brain.
And let me stop you for a minute, Dan, and just say, people, try this. Just follow along with Dan, because this is going to be something useful for you, maybe to teach someone else. So go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Ruth. So we have this hand model of the brain, and if I reach over here and grab this brain, we can use this as a model just to show you. This is a double-sized brain, so it's big, but the hand model would basically be shaped like this, where this back of the brain is the back of your hand, the front of the brain is the front here where your fingernails are. So when you open up the brain, which I'll do here with the hand model now that we have it here, what you find, and this is obviously just a plastic model, but what you find is there's three major areas we can talk about. The brain stem is the deepest area, and that would be represented if you open up your fingers and your thumb. This area here in the plastic model, in your hand model, it's in your right there in your palm, and then this area just here, you can't really see it because it's actually more inside the medial temporal lobe, is the limbic area. There's a left and right side. That's the thumb area, and then the outer bark of the brain here is the cortex, represented by your fingers like that. You see how that is just an enlarged view of that. So in the hand model, let's just go through it and see what we know changes in the adolescent brain. So if you lift your fingers up and lift your thumb up, you now have got your brain stem. This is where you have fight, flight, freeze, and faint processes mediated by certain neurons, the basic cell of the brain, and also whether you're awake or asleep. So clearly the changes in sleep patterns in adolescence is changing during this period too. Adolescents stay up later, they need to sleep longer, and schools don't respect that. And so we're having a lot of adolescents with their natural sleep rhythm changes not really taken into account. And these kids are profoundly sleep deprived. And sleep deprivation, as you know, directly impairs neural functioning, so your ability to remember what you learn, your ability to pay attention, even your ability to stay awake is impaired, and it affects insulin processing, so your tendency to gain weight and have diabetes is massively increased. So the ability to fight off stress and disease, your immune system isn't functioning well. So we're saying this, we're going to go through each part of the brain, but for an adolescent then, both the change in sleep timing and the amount of homework they generally have, plus all the digital things that stimulate the brain and keep the brain up long after it should have been falling asleep, is a problem. So in all these ways, these basic physiological processes mediated by the brainstem are hugely challenging for an adolescent. That's just to put a frame on it, not just about risk. When you put your thumb over, two thumbs would be a perfect model. This is the limbic area in the hand model of the brain. Five major functions that we've talked about, but I'll review for you with them. One is generating emotion by working with the brainstem and the body itself. That's the subcortical origins of emotion. Jaak Panksepp and Lucy Bivens' book, The Archaeology of Mind, I'm the founding editor of the Norton series on interpersonal neurobiology. That's one of the books in our series. We look deeply at these subcortical origins of emotion. So emotion, number one. And we know that for the adolescent brain, emotions are pushing much more up into the cortex, the higher part of the brain where you reason, than they were in childhood. So we can call that the ES, the emotional spark. And that's a the prelude to our essence. So that's the first one, ES, emotional spark. The next thing is motivation. The brainstem and the limbic area, these two areas work together to motivate us. And motivation shifts in adolescence. So a lot of times what happens is middle school and high school experiences are not that motivating for kids, but they can be motivated to do all sorts of other things. And so we need to understand that deep in the limbic area, you're getting shifts in the brain on motivation. And one of the motivations is to push away from parent figures. And you can see from our adaptive model why that would be useful to do, to have these deep structures getting you ready to leave the nest. You need to push away. That's not, you know, some immaturity. It's a form of transformation, not immaturity. And a lot of parents don't know how to understand that. And what's exciting about the Brainstorm book and people who have taken it in, they've said, wow, this totally changes how I interpret my adolescent's behavior. Or even for an adolescent themselves, they can understand there's a natural push deep here in the limbic area, how it's working with the brainstem. So that's number two. We have emotion, number one, motivation. Number three is this area is very important for something called appraisal. And appraisal is basically your limbic area filtering both stimuli from the outside world and stimuli from the inside world. Thoughts, an example of the inside world, perceptions from the outside world. And it evaluates the meaning of them. It says, is this thing important or not? If it's important, is it good or bad? If it's good, I want more of it. How do I get it? If it's bad, I want less of it. How do I get away from it? The appraisal system of the limbic area is changing in adolescence, as it needs to. And if teachers keep on drilling kids with the same kind of thing they had in third grade and fourth grade, it's not going to work. So I'm working with school systems, whole districts, in fact, to take a brainstorm approach to this, to say, why don't we embrace some of these understandings of the adaptive, transformative brain changes that are needed to try to really invite the appraisal system of an adolescent brain to say, this is important and I want more of it. And there are ways we can talk about later how we do that, but that's what we're doing. So that's appraisal changes. Number four is memory. As we said, you know, sleep deprivation makes it hard to remember things. The hippocampus is in this region, and stress really decreases hippocampal functioning. And so we need to realize that stress not only does that, and we'll see later on that the pruning that's going on in the brain, especially in the cortex, can be exacerbated by stress. And the hippocampus, along with the hypothalamus, are working in our stress response and helping regulate ourselves. The fifth function of the limbic area that also changes and is challenged during adolescence is attachment. You know, attachment in the simplest way is how we as mammals need an attachment figure to give us four S's. We are seen by the attachment figure. We're safe with the attachment figure. We are soothed by the attachment figure. And we feel secure with the attachment figure. So all of these S's, seen, safe, soothed, and secure, we have with our parents when we're children, infants, toddlers, elementary school age kids. But the limbic area changes. This is the attachment aspect of limbic functioning. It changes during adolescence, such that instead of turning to our parents, we turn to our peers. And I call this social engagement, the second part of our acronym. We have emotional spark, and now we've got social engagement. The social engagement is essential for the adolescent's adaptation, because if you leave the nest and go out into the wider world without an adolescent support group, in the wild, you're as good as dead. So social engagement is not just about caving to peer pressure. It's an evolutionarily created push driven by the limbic area to have membership with your adolescent group so you don't die. Literally, it works with the fight, flight, freeze, reactive states of the life threat, to work together to motivate you to be belong somewhere. So when an adolescent comes to a parent and says, I need to have this kind of jacket, or I need to go to, not this kind of jacket, but you know, I need to have some kind of clothing, and you don't have to buy it, but at least you can, as a parent, appreciate the sense of life and death about it. You know, and the same thing is true with just belonging. And the downside, each of these things have upsides and downsides. The downside, of course, is you cave into peer pressure if your peers are asking you to do wild things like take risky behaviors. That's not good. But we need to recognize there's an upside to it too. Now, All of this is happening. And then we fold our fingers over the top. The cortex is also changing. The whole system is changing by two fundamental processes, pruning and myelination. So what we didn't know before, and we know now in the last dozen years or so, is that there's a massive change in the brain. Some groups, like at UCLA, believe, and other groups don't believe it, so it's kind of controversial, that around 10 or 11 before puberty hits, there's kind of this resurgence of growth, there's a growth spurt. Other labs don't believe that, so that's up in the air. But what is not controversial is that, whether there's that growth spurt or not, that during the adolescent period, two things happen. Pruning, where you're carving away neural connections and even neurons that you don't need, so it's a use it or lose it principle, maybe exacerbated by stress, which may be the reason, by the way, that every major psychiatric disorder has its onset most likely during the dozen years of life of adolescence. It's absolutely amazing, but that's what's happening. So rather than thinking of it as hormones out of control or something, there's no evidence for that. Of course, with puberty, you have a rise in sexual hormones, but we believe it's this pruning process that may unveil genetically vulnerable circuits or experientially induced circuits or some combination of the two, where the pruning actually reveals underlying vulnerability and circuitry. So what we know, too, is that besides the pruning and the myelination is basically laying down connections among the remaining neurons, so their coordination and balance and their speed is basically 3,000 times more effective, 100 times faster speed of ions flowing in and out of the membrane called the action potential, 30 times quicker refractory period where you recover from having sent an action potential down, 30 times 100 is 3,000. So for a given circuit, if you're myelinated, you're 3,000 times more effective. Now, basically, overall, what that means is the adolescent brain is actually becoming more integrated. It's differentiated through pruning, it's linking through myelination, and it's becoming more efficient, actually. Surprise to many adults, but it is. And now, it's not the only thing that's changing, but one of the things that's changing throughout the whole system, limbic area, brainstem, and cortex, is the influence of something called the dopamine system. And this gets to the question of why kids do risky behaviors, how they can. One of the leading scientific thoughts at this moment, of course things always change, but is that the dopamine system, which is the neurotransmitter of reward, is actually lower in its baseline level in its dopamine circuitry in the adolescent brain. But the release levels are higher. And what this finding helps us understand is that there's a restless sensation with an adolescent, boredom. I got to do something. I've got to do something that releases my dopamine. Now, one of the basic things that releases dopamine is novelty. And so one of the thoughts about risk-taking behavior is that you're driven because of this dopamine shift, lower baseline, elevated release, you're compelled to try something new because novelty secretes dopamine. Now, the good part about that is you can leave the home because it's new to leave home, leave the familiar world, and you can populate the planet in new ways that your adults that raised you never thought of. Those are the good things. That's the novelty of the essence. Emotional spark, ES, social engagement, and is novelty or novelty seeking. And this novelty then is wonderful. The downside is drugs of abuse stimulate dopamine release. Activities, you know, some people say video games. Other people say eating high glycemic foods, foods that release high levels of blood sugar in rapid ways. Those are addicting now. We know that. So, you know, these are times during adolescence when if you're going to become addicted, it's most likely during the second dozen years of life during adolescence. So this is the downside to it. There's an upside to it, too. The last thing I just want to say in response to your question is the last part of essence, emotional spark, social engagement, novelty, and the CE is creative explorations. The brain of an adolescent, since it's pushing away from adults, pushing away from the status quo, and the cortex itself, which basically is mapping out all sorts of things. The back of it maps out three-dimensional space, usually with the eyes. The side for mapping out sound. The upper side, the parietal lobes, for mapping out the limits of our body. The front frontal lobe for thinking conceptually is developing a lot during adolescence, especially the prefrontal cortex is developing. It's transforming in its pruning and myelination. It's becoming more and more integrated through time. One thing we believe happens is that you're literally able to think about things in new combinations called creative explorations. And what happens in this process is you have something which people didn't realize, because everyone was saying, oh, adolescents are doing risky things because they're impulsive. Now, that's partially true, that in early teenage years, the ability to resist an impulse, in fact, is hard to do because of the remodeling of the brain. That's true. But risky behavior continues when impulsivity has subsided. And there's another mechanism beyond, and in many ways more concerning than impulsivity, because impulsivity, you say, is learn to control your impulses, do mindfulness meditation, whatever you're going to do, develop more self-awareness. That's important for sure. The second mechanism is something that surprised everybody. It's called hyper-rational thinking. And what it is, if you picture our brain hand model, it's where the limbic area is appraising the significance of the positive, thrilling, boundary-breaking aspects of a possible activity and minimizing the appraisal of significance to the downsides, to the risks, to the cons. It elevates the pros. Should I do it or not? Yeah, pro, pro, pro. It minimizes the cons. So unlike what many parents think, that adolescents are just not informed about danger, research shows usually, in fact, they do know about the danger. In fact, in some situations, they overestimate the likelihood of danger, but they carry out the behavior anyway, which is like totally confusing. Why is that? Well, the limbic area is skewed this way. Minimize a concern about the dangers, maximize, hyper-emphasize the pros. Now, when you combine that with why, this is why it's called hyper-rational thinking. If you say to me, Ruth, Dan, as I'm an adolescent with hyper-rational thinking, you say, Dan, here's a gun. I'm going to give you one bullet, six chambers. We're going to spin it around. I want you to shoot it at your head. What's the most likely thing that will happen? And what will you do? Now, obviously, this is extreme, but just to give you a feeling for what hyper-rational thinking is all about, I say, well, let's see. Why would I do this, Ruth? You say, well, I'll give you $6 million. I go, oh, wow, that's a pretty cool gift. Thank you, Ruth. Let's see. If 100 of me did it, 5/6 of the time, that would work out fine, right? So 5/6 compared to a 6 is a majority of time. 5/6 of $6 million is $5 million. So the likelihood of 100 of me doing it, the likelihood is I'll get $5 million, right? That's the average every person doing it would do. And since it's the most likely thing to do it, I think I'll do it, right? Now, that's hyper-rational thinking. Now, when you de-emphasize the downside, of course, you shoot the gun. Because it is true, a hyper-rational probability calculation, the statement saying, the most likely outcome is for Dan to get the money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Totally rational. Mm-hmm. Now, what, Ruth, why wouldn't you do it? What in your experience would get you not to do it?
Because the downside is too awful.
The downside is too awful. And what gave you that feeling?
Well, you would die if you successfully shot the bullet into your head.
Right, but... isn't it true that the most likely outcome is that you'll get the money?
Oh, absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. So then why wouldn't you do it? What's wrong with you? Aren't you
like,
don't you
play the stock market? Because the downside is too costly.
The downside is too costly. Okay. So you're feeling the reality of the cost of the downside. So if we're saying that the adolescent limbically is not evaluating the meaning of the downside, which is what we believe, because that allows them to go out of the house and take risks. Otherwise, they'd stay at home. And in the old days, maybe the danger was, you know, you'd have a lion run after you, and maybe you would get eaten, or, you know, you'd go out and you'd be scared or something. But now we have drugs, we have guns, We have cars that kids drive with alcohol. So the stakes in many, many ways, for real, are much more serious, maybe than in the old days. You have kids with guns going into schools and shooting. These are mostly adolescents shooting other adolescents, right? I mean, so we're living in a different age where the stakes are much higher. There's no question about that. So people say, well, what are you going to do if the limbic area is balanced this way? So this is what I talk about in the Brainstorm book, and I appeal to the adolescent reading it and the adult reading it too, to take on these things I call mindsight exercises, because the way around this, research suggests, no one's proven it, but we've got to do the best we can with what the science that we now have, is that if you teach an adolescent to go beneath the emotional limbic appraisal and go to intuitive reasoning, which comes literally from the neural networks, we believe. We need more research to validate this, but this is what the thought is. The neural networks around my heart, the neural networks around my intestine are going to literally process my value system, which is perfectly intact in me as an adolescent. I may not have conscious access to it. I may not be able to articulate it, but I can have a gut feeling and a heartfelt sense. So when you offer me the gun, limbically pushing up on my cortex, I can hyper-rationally say, of course I'll shoot it. Or as one guy did, sadly, just in the street right near here, drove 95 miles an hour and killed my favorite teacher, a 19-year-old. I'm sure when he got in the car, he was just thrilled with the idea of going 95 miles an hour on a curvy street, you know. And maybe there was a 1/6 chance that a person would be in his way, but 5/6 chance it wouldn't, and he'd been doing that for a while. So, okay, so what's the story here? The story is, and this is partly why I wrote the book Brainstorm, if someone would have taught that 19-year-old to have more self-awareness, including this process we now call interoception, to have perception of the signals from his heart, the signals from his intestine, they go up lamina 1, layer 1 of the spinal cord. They go up the 10th cranial nerve, the vagus nerve. They ultimately find their way past the brainstem and up past the limbic area and then into, some people call it limbic, but basically the area called the anterior cingulate and the anterior insula, especially on the right side of the brain. And it gives you a feeling, probably with the voniconimo neurons that link the anterior cingulate to the anterior insula. You get self-awareness. So if he had been given reflective exercises when he was younger adolescent, this 19-year-old, if he had had it in school, if his parents encouraged him to read the Brainstorm book, my hope, my deepest hope, is that in a preventative way, people with that kind of self-awareness with interoception gain access to the positive values. So you can't say to an adolescent as an adult, don't do it. I mean, you can say it, but it's not going to have much effect. You can try to inform them, don't you know it's dangerous? And that's not going to have much of an effect, the studies show. But if you tap into the positive values that adolescents have, I like to think of it like an internal compass. The heart and the intestine will literally send the wisdom of the body up into the right anterior cingulate and right anterior insula, linked by the voniconimo neurons that you can probably grow. We need research to prove this, but I'll bet you it'll be shown in the next 5 years. Then what happens is with that self-awareness, that boy says, I really want to drive fast, but you know something? Something doesn't feel right about it. I'm getting images of killing someone. Ugh, I don't like to kill people. Oof, I might even die. That doesn't feel right. I'm not going to do it. That came from an internal compass, not an adult's mandate. So this hyper-rational thinking has a counterpart, which is self-awareness through mindful practices. I call the mindsight practice, which is insight, empathy, and integration is what mindsight includes. And throughout the Brainstorm book, I'm teaching this. And the idea is if we do this not in a crisis, but we do this as a matter of fundamental education where people develop this kind of self-awareness, I'll bet you we can reduce the actions that adolescents do that harm themselves or harm others, including, like sadly for my teacher, being killed. And sadly for this 19-year-old, who's now obviously much older, this is years and years ago, you know, he has to live his whole life knowing that an action that he chose to do killed a human being. So it's a lose-lose situation. So can we channel the need for speed somewhere else? Can we channel this need for risk into rites of passage and having non-parental adult figures stay within the lives of adolescents? These are all things we can all change the cultural conversation about adolescents instead of saying they're immature and they're impulsive, they can't pay attention, they're nuts, and it's just a horrible period. Let's change the cultural conversation about adolescents so we say, something? If we think deeply about what's actually going on, these are the most courageous and creative people on the planet. We need to tap into their creativity, harness their courage, channel all this passion, and allow ourselves to actually support each other. After all, most adults once were adolescents, as far as I know, and we can do this. And this is about cultural change mediated by professionals, teachers, therapists, mediated by policymakers, mediated by people who run school systems, mediated by the parent world, and mediated by adolescents themselves. So it can be a cultural shift in how we approach this incredibly important and wonderful period of life.
So let's talk about the addicted teenage brain. Can you first just give us an idea of the dopamine system? Because that seems to be so relevant to the addicted brain.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. I mean, we'll talk about the dopamine system. And we'll talk also about epigenetics, that there are changes in gene expression that are happening in general during the adolescent period. And if you're exposed to a substance and you are potentially vulnerable to becoming addicted, it looks like that genetic shift in gene expression actually can make it so that using that substance becomes incredibly compelling. And it's focused on a particular substance, if you will, in the clinical literature, we call it substance of choice, right? So we need to understand epigenetics are affected too by exposure to chemicals that are potentially addictive. Our understanding of addictive substances as well as addictive behaviors is they engage the dopamine system. The reason adolescence is particularly vulnerable is because of these shifts in the dopamine system we described earlier, where you're getting this lower baseline, this increased release. That's what's thought at this moment. So when you imagine that and you realize that any behavior or substance that's addictive is in activating the dopamine system, it's in training the system so that the way the system gets, in quotes, used to being released is by this jolt that we used to think was just from the substance itself. Now we need to realize that studies are suggesting that, yes, the substance may induce dopamine release. And so let's say I'm a student who's starting, let's use alcohol, a very common drug of abuse that you can get addicted to. Not everybody gets addicted to it, but some people may be vulnerable to that. So let's say, and I talk about this in one of the cases of a patient I saw who was emerging with alcoholism. And so you'll see this way I try to describe to her and help her come to terms with the idea that when your dopamine system becomes entrained to have release from a substance, it makes other things like friendships that can release dopamine less exciting because you're getting a sudden jolt with the substance, whereas a friendship maybe is a gradual rise. Working hard on an art project, gradual rise. Now you finished it. You put it into an art show, you wait. Some people like it, some people don't. It's a dopamine rise that rises and falls. You can tolerate that rise and fall, but not her, not this person who's addicted because she needs the sudden rise. Now, the sudden rise, of course, is followed by a precipitous drop. And that drop for an adolescent goes to a baseline that's lower. So, of course, there's this restless feeling, and now you get used to the rise again. What we've learned in recent times is that it's not just a substance. It's the behavior around the substance, which means the environment you're in can release dopamine that you're used to getting drunk in. The friends you're with can release it, maybe not the same degree, but also the anticipation of using it. So the experiments are fascinating where they have people anticipate getting something and they start getting a rise in it. You can look at that and say, well, then just don't give the substance. Well, after a while, people realize they're not getting the substance, but here's the thing about it. It takes over your whole life. It's not just when I get it. It's when I'm anticipating getting it. It's planning my whole life. It's organizing my whole life around this thing. Now, the great news about dopamine is that it's rewarding and leads to novelty. What we want to do is harness constructive, positive, health-promoting novelty. And because the brain is firing in all these different ways, you can take a different approach. It's why I think mindful approaches to substance abuse and getting off of substances when you're addicted to them is such a powerful thing, because in many ways, mindfulness allows you to create novelty in everyday moments. But it's a serious thing, and it's one of the psychiatric conditions, drug addiction, among the many others, like schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, that generally the majority of people are going to develop them, not all, but the majority have their onset during adolescence.
I want to work our way into integrating the teenage brain. And before we do, I want to go back to, you talked about pruning and the whole idea of epigenetics. And if we're pruning during, it can bring out some of the vulnerable parts of the brain if the person's had epigenetically vulnerable experiences.
Yes.
I don't think I followed that because I've been with us through the brain series the last several years, and also through the trauma series. But for the people who don't, can we just sort of unpack that a little more?
Absolutely. And I think whenever we unpack something like that, as you're so beautifully doing in your series, Ruth, we need to be really humble about it, that we present, you know, a perspective, and this perspective is built from science, but science is an unfolding story. And so we need to see where we're at now in the science of things, knowing it can always change. And also, as we work as parents or work as clinicians, that we need to keep open to, how do we build the practical ways we parent or provide therapeutic interventions that are informed by science, knowing we need to go beyond science, of course, so that when a person is in front of us, we work with our clinical intuition, our clinical presence in all sorts of ways. So I'll present the science about this. To me, it explains a lot. And what you want to do, and what we do in interpersonal neurobiology, is create a framework that then can be set up and then later tested so that you find more supportive evidence, maybe not proof, but supportive evidence. So if you read a book, The Developing Mind, second edition, you'll see this effort to disprove a lot of what I'm about to say, but there's a lot of supportive evidence for it. So let's look at it. In interpersonal neurobiology, just to give you the broad picture, we say that health comes from a process called integration, and that integration, the linkage of differentiated parts, happens both within your body. So it's how your nervous system, for example, links different aspects of itself and connects them. So we look for something called neural integration that you can reveal now in what's called the human connectome. The connectome is the interconnected nature of the differentiated parts of the nervous system. It's a beautiful and lovely way of talking about what we've talked about in interpersonal neurobiology for years, which is the process of integration. So now in modern literature, it's being called the human connectome. And you can make proposals, which we did back in the 90s, which was that integration leads to harmony, that it leads to this flexible, adaptive, coherently held together, energized and stable movement of a system across time. So in the nervous system, integration creates adaptability. In a relationship like between me and you, we would honor differences and promote linkages, and that would be an integrated relationship. So for me, as an attachment researcher, you know, I look deeply at patterns of communication between parents and children, and when they're integrated, they promote well-being in the child. And now we're beginning to unveil how, in fact, integrated communication stimulates the growth of integrative fibers in the brain. And the reason that's important is that integration in the brain is the basis of all regulation. So whether you're regulating emotion, attention, thought, behavior, interpersonal understanding, all of those regulatory things that some people call self-regulation, other people like to call executive function, for us, they all emerge out of a process of linking differentiated parts of the nervous system. So, to get to your question about pruning, we need to realize that the brain grows based on three fundamental things that happen. One, the genetics you're born with, which is the sequence of nucleotides that comprise your genes on your chromosomes that you inherit. Two, the epigenetic factors that you either inherit as histones and methyl groups, these non-nucleic acids, molecules that sit on top of the DNA that alter the structure of the double helix to make it either more likely or less likely that the gene will be activated or what's called expressed. Those are called epigenetic regulatory things, and we know you get them either by inheriting them, or you can also acquire them through your own experience, which is mind-blowingly new. That is, only in the last, well, within this millennium, we're really learning about the epigenetic factors that regulate gene expression. Incredibly important. And the two realities are you can change the epigenetic control of gene expression through your own experience, like if you were abused, and you can inherit the experientially derived epigenetic factors from your grandparents, even, depending on the timing. And that's an incredibly new finding, but we need to just state it straight out. Genetics, epigenetics. The third factor is experience. Experience not only changes epigenetic regulation, so that fits into our second category, it changes the way neurons link up to each other. So literally, the function of the nervous system is changed by experience, and with either intense experience or repeated experience, you can change the structural connections in the nervous system, which include growing new neurons, neuronal linkages called synapses, and even myelin is affected by experience. So in all those ways, the myelinated, interconnected structure of the neuronal complex system of the nervous system is affected by experience. Okay, all that being said, in our view, in interpersonal neurobiology, any of those three factors can contribute to inhibiting the healthy, integrated growth of the brain. So you can have a genetic predisposition, let's say, for schizophrenia, and if your mother was exposed to the flu virus, you know, you may reveal that. But another mother was exposed to the flu virus and you weren't genetically predisposed, you won't get schizophrenia. So that's one of the many hypotheses about schizophrenia. Nothing you experience from attachment causes schizophrenia, but exposure to a virus if you're genetically at risk. So you need to understand that. Schizophrenia, according to Marcus Raichel, impaired integration in the brain. When is it often revealed? During adolescence. Now, let's use bipolar disorder as another example. We don't know the exact genes or epigenetic issues, but we don't believe it's from attachment. So genetics or epigenetics may make it so that if you believe the work out of Yale, Hilary Bloomberg's work shows that you have a compromised integrative set of functions from the ventral lateral area, especially in the right side of the brain, down to the amygdala. So this would be impaired linkage as a demonstration of the impaired integration. What happens in manic depressive illness? You're prone to either becoming chaotically manic or rigidly depressed. So in our view, chaos and rigidity are the areas outside a river of integration, which is harmony. And when you blow through that river, you either go to the bank of chaos or the bank of rigidity, manic depressive illness being an example. So let's use that as an example. And Marcus Raichel also has shown that integration is impaired with bipolar disorder as well as in autism. And those are areas that are not caused by experience, but just so I don't forget, the experientially derived impairments integration that Marty Teicher has shown at Harvard University McLean Hospital is basically with abuse and neglect. That these forms of post-traumatic conditions have impairments to the major integrative fibers of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, which links cortex, limbic area, brainstem, body, and social world together, is not growing well after neglect or abuse. The corpus callosum connecting the left and the right, and the hippocampus, which integrates memory. Those are the three major areas that Teicher has found are impaired following experience. But to stick with a non-experiential example, with someone with bipolar disorder, what may happen, and let me give you just a hypothetical, these numbers are just for the sake of teaching and thinking about this conceptually. Let's say for your mood to stay within equanimity, to be balanced and integrated, you need your prefrontal region to keep your limbic area and your brainstem and the input from the body in some kind of balance. So you need, let's just say, 2,000 fibers to go from the prefrontal cortex downward to the limbic area to keep things regulated. Those would be inhibitory fibers that would secrete things like GABA, gamma-aminobutyric acid, or other substances that downplay the firing of the reactive limbic area influenced by the brainstem and the body. Okay, so that would be called, in regular terms, emotional balance. You need 2,000, let's say. Let's say during the pre-pubertal period, pre-adolescence, you're now 7, 8, 9 years of age. You've had fine attachments, your relationships are great, but you've genetically inherited too few of those cells, but you have 3,000 of them, right? And let's say the pruning process, just to make the math easy, carves away 50% of the connections. So you have 3,000 and you're 8 years old, your friends have 6,000, okay? But all you need is 2,000 to function well. So for a teacher or a friend or anybody looking at what's going on, you're all fine. The phenotype, what's expressed as an 8-year-old, is fine. The genotype, though, may be that you have too few. Let's just put it, no one knows that for sure, but let's just put that as the model. Now you enter the adolescent period, which can correlate with the onset of sexual maturation or puberty, or it can be different. And now you start carving away your 50% because you're genetically programmed to differentiate and link to integrate over these next period of years, the adolescent period. So, okay, so now you're from 3,000, you're going to go to half. So what do you go to, Ruth? If you have 3,000, you go down to 1,500, but you need 2,000 for it to work well. Now, the sad thing is what happens at that moment is you don't have enough inhibitory fibers so that the natural way the body, the brainstem, and the limbic area are going to push this emotional juice upward, which is fine, which is bigger anyway during adolescence. That's true. That's the emotional spark. It's got to run into at least 2,000 to be regulated, but there's only 1,500 now. That creates massive dysfunction, chaos of mania, then and explosive emotions, rigidity of feeling depleted and depressed. And now, sadly, what we believe happens is the cortisol secreted from the increased stress of being dysregulated increases pruning. So now you'd only stay with 1,500. Maybe now, because of your own genetic predisposition plus genetically programmed natural healthy pruning, you've cut the down from 3,000 to 1,500, you're having more stress. Now you're down to 1,000, maybe you're down to 750. And depending on how your family responds or how the school responds or whether you have therapy or not early on or maybe even medications and certainly whether you have mindfulness meditation taught to you, because that can grow these fibers. If you don't have any of that stuff and the stress is bad, it gets worse and worse. So the unfolding of a psychiatric disturbance is understood by the pruning process. And also its natural evolution can massively be changed depending on how early intervention is introduced, which can include medications, but can also include and should include interventions like mind training programs that increase the potential for regulation. So now David Miklovitz at UCLA is engaged in an active study. The results aren't in yet, but the preliminary pilot study that he did is very positive. And the case examples I have are not a study. They're just case examples, but they're data that makes us hopeful. We need to do the controlled, randomized, double-blind study, which is being done, to take women who want to get pregnant, who have bipolar disorder, and you cannot take those medications when you're trying to get pregnant. They're toxic to the fetus. So ethically, from an ethics review board, these are people that must come off their medications. And bipolar disorder is at risk of suicide. So it's not a simple thing to say to come off your medications. Okay, but these people have to. They want to. Then he's teaching them mindfulness meditation. What we need to see, because the results aren't in yet, is how mindfulness, from the pilot studies it looks good, but we need to do it in a controlled way. We need to see if, in fact, you can use a mind training program even in someone who we believe is genetically or epigenetically at risk for this too few number of neurons, that's the study out of Yale, to then say, can we grow those fibers And that's also work of Marcus Raichel to show that it's impaired integration, looking at what's called the default mode. Anyway, what we want to do is grow these integrative fibers through mindfulness training. That doesn't mean a person won't need medications. Maybe they do. This doesn't make medications the bad guy. In fact, some studies of lithium show it promotes neuroplasticity, the growth of neurons in response to experience. The point here is that why not offer a mind training program that actually is designatingly growing the very fibers that may be genetically deficient? So the great, great news is that if this works, we're basically saying that even if the cause is genetic, the solution may be experiential, that we shouldn't separate these out. This is not nature versus nurture. It doesn't make any sense. It's bio-illogical to say that. We can use the focus of energy and information streams, which is the mind, to stream energy through the nervous system, we're calling that the brain, so that you can actually grow fibers, that's neuroplasticity, that are integrative. And this is the exciting thing of being in the mental health field now, whether you're in medicine or nursing or social work or psychotherapy that you're doing as a psychiatrist, a psychologist, anybody. The great news is we can all work together when we encapsulate the idea that integration is health. Impaired integration leads to any of these syndromes of the DSM. They're all examples of chaos, rigidity, or both. And the proposal then is how we can use a psychotherapeutic intervention to promote integration. And adolescence, as you can see, is such a crucial time because the pruning process and then the myelination, of course, which theoretically may be impaired with stress, we want to optimize myelination and optimize pruning. You need pruning, but you want to make sure that if you have vulnerable circuits, which may even be there from experience, this proposal was it's of a genetic thing, but even if it's there from an experience, adolescence is a really important time to try to capture a connection with this individual, help them build the strength of the integrative circuits in the brain. And the reason in Brainstorm I wanted adolescents to read this book was because I believe so deeply in prevention. And my feeling was, if you could teach these mindset skills that grow integrative fibers to everyone, that it's a win-win situation. You don't have to wait to see if a 10-year-old, when he or she is 18, is going to unveil suboptimal circuitry. Why not give everyone these tools? So even if they start showing trouble, they've set a foundation with these skills.
I'm sorry, I'm afraid we have to stop, but everyone, check out Dan's book. It's called Brainstorm, The Power and Purpose of the Teenage Brain. I think you'll find it very, very informative. I think you'll want your kids to read it as well. And I highly recommend it. Dan, thanks so much for your work and for all that you've done and for being here.
My pleasure, Ruth. Thank you very much.
We hope you've enjoyed part one of this short, focused course. Next, in part two, we'll dig more deeply into the teaching you've just heard. This segment will help you synthesize key concepts so you can use them immediately. After that, you'll discover concrete strategies in part three for implementing this course in your life and with your patients. In part four, the Quick Start Guide, you'll get the core ideas and techniques at a glance so you'll have a cheat sheet when you need it most. And part five gives you the complete transcript of the course so you can quickly recall crucial details and apply them with confidence. You'll find the links for each of these on the confirmation page you received when you purchased the course. Thanks for watching.